Garden State Debate, where the talk is real. Garden State Debate, no joke, no frills. Garden State Debate, it's the talk of the town. Garden State Debate, for people all around, yeah. Garden State Debate,
Garden State Debate,
Garden State Debate.
We're very excited today to continue our discussion around, which we had with Dominic and Gail from Winona's House on child advocacy, the Child Advocacy Center in Essex County, Winona's House. We have with us today Dr. Prempe, who is a psychologist and who works out of Beth Israel Medical Center in Newark. And through her work, she's part of the RDTC program, the Regional Diagnostic Treatment Center at Winona's House. And I'm sure she can tell us a lot more about that. And also a bunch of other things and experiences that she's been involved with and continuing to look at as part of her work, including things such as adverse childhood experiences and just generally, not generally, but specifically as well, COVID-19 and its mental impacts that it's had on parents and kids and the school system and other things that are going on. So with that, I'd like to welcome you, Dr. Prempe. Welcome to the show. I hope you're doing well. How's everything going?
Things are going well. Thank you so much for having me. Currently, you know, I'm experiencing a little bit of stress, but it's the good stress being on here right now. Yeah.
Yeah, you mentioned what there was a term for that as well.
It's called eustress. You know, stress is our body's typical reaction to any situation that we're in. And when we think of stress, we're thinking more of de-stress, which is the negative impacts of it, right? That negative stress per se. But sometimes we have stress in a positive way that motivates us and things of that nature. So for instance, stress to being on this podcast today. Just recently, I was a keynote speaker at a conference. So I had a stress leading up to that, and really just so that it pushes me and motivates me to do well. So there's two types of stress, and I'm experiencing the good stress right now, which is the stress.
Great. No, I thought that was interesting. I think a lot of people associate stress with a, you know, semi-negative connotation. So I think we're going to learn a lot today. And thanks again for coming on to the show. And I know I probably missed like 98% of all the wonderful things that you're up to and through your work and stuff like that. So if you want to kind of tack on to the background I gave and other things you've been involved with and kind of how you came about in terms of your career, I think you were telling me how you've been involved with the juvenile justice system and that kind of led you to what, maybe you can give us a little background on how we got to where we are.
Yeah, so try to do it briefly because it is a lot. Just really became very interested, and actually it's somewhat connected to the late rapper that just passed, Earl DMX Simmons. You know, when I was in high school, I really loved his music and actually wanted to get to know more about him. And there was a magazine article about him and he shared, you know, his battles with depression and talked about his childhood trauma that he experienced and history of in and out of group homes and incarceration and things of that nature. So I really became intrigued and wanted to understand like the connections between that. And so I went to college, initially started out as a bio major and then switched over to psychology, went to John Jay for my master's in forensic psychology, which really looks at, you know, individuals that engage in criminal or defiant behavior, and then also victimology as well. And, you know, did my externship at a juvenile probation and detention center in New Jersey, went on for my doctorate in clinical and school psychology, and did my internship at a juvenile probation and detention center. And really while there, I got to see firsthand the statistic that I think now it should be up more like up to about like 90%, don't quote me please, of children that are in the juvenile justice system have a history of trauma. And I saw that in a lot of the assessments that I did and the therapies that I did at the juvenile detention center in San Antonio, Texas. And then my focus shifted because I felt as though to better help children that are in the justice system, I had to learn trauma better, learn how to treat and address trauma. And so that's how I got to the RDTC. And the RDTC is really came out of this concept of, with child advocacy centers being like a one-stop place where if a child experienced abuse, instead of them having to go to the police department or the prosecutor's office, to detectives, to the hospital, to the child protection agency, and things of that nature, it's all housed in one location, which is the Child Advocacy Center. So like you had Dominic on here, I'm sure he talked a lot about that. So with my work, I do that. We're actually located within Wynonna's house, even though we're still through North Bethel Israel Medical Center. The department is both at the hospital and there's a department in the Child Advocacy Center. And we provide the medical and psychological services. So in the work that I do, you know, I do evaluation and treatment for children who've been abused and neglected, and, you know, have testified on the stand as an expert witness, and also train doctoral students in doing this work as well. So that's one of the things that I do. And then I've also, in that work, really getting to understand trauma and being a part of the New Jersey Association of Black Psychologists, which now I'm the vice president for, I was able to connect with a nonprofit organization called Equal Justice USA and doing police community trauma work in the city of Newark. So we've done a series of, you know, community-based trainings where it's unique. Police officers and community members are together and going through this training to understand the impact of trauma. And this is like the full, really like the different array of traumas, from individual trauma to understanding community, mass trauma, racial trauma, right? And also vicarious trauma, which officers experience from the work that they do. And through these trainings, you know, it's been very phenomenal. It's taken the community from a place of trauma to a place of trust and things of that nature. So I've been very grateful to be a part of that work since it started back in 2016. And then through that, I really got interested in the impact of racial trauma, and currently now am doing consulting for an independent school in New York around racial trauma that the students have experienced. So I'm busy, but it's all good child advocacy work and community building, I would say.
No, that's great. Sounds like you're definitely keeping busy over there. That's quite a bit of experience. And so I guess if we kind of dive in first with Wynonna's house, and then we can see what, if we have time for a couple of the other things that you mentioned, I'd be interested in hearing more about them. But you did mention the kind of the co-location and services that you provide for Wynonna's. And you mentioned kind of some of the work that you've done as far as psych evaluations and things like that. Can you give us like a general sense of you said we a couple times. Is there more of you? Is it a bigger department? Is there other, so you're a psychologist, is there other medical staff that are also part of, and yeah.
Yes, sorry to cut you off. There's definitely, it's a psychologist, social workers really working together to, you know, support and address childhood trauma. And so we have a clinical director. Actually, we're led by our clinical director, Dr. Christine Baker, who is the clinical director. And we also are able to do a lot of different types of treatments, from individual therapy that are trauma-informed, evidence-based practices, to also doing group therapy for kids who've experienced trauma, and also having a parent group And, you know, the RDTC in general also does parent training and things of that nature. So a lot of services, you know, really under the DCF grant and things of that nature to support children in Essex County that have experienced abuse. And there's, I will mention that there is about approximately 4 to 5 different regional diagnostic treatment centers throughout the state that covers different regions across the state. Yeah.
Yeah, that's a good point and interesting. We hope to get to that at some point. Obviously, Winona's House sounds like they are one of the only like co-located according to what I've read, and having Dominic and Gail on the show, but there's an advocacy center in each county. So with that, there's RDTC centers, maybe not in each of them, but across the state. So we hope to get that information up and out to people who are listening across the state as well. But maybe you can tell us a little bit more about some of the specifics then, now that we know kind of your role as it relates to the advocacy center and being, you know, on site, getting into whatever level of detail you feel comfortable with. But, and I know there's, you talked a lot about when we spoke before about like the resiliency side of things. So there's obviously the trauma, abuse or neglect, the event or events that are going on. And then there's obviously a treatment process, and then and then you come out on the other side, hopefully in a much better and healthier place. So maybe you can talk a little bit about some of those types of tasks and programs and things that you use, tools that you use within your profession to help the advocacy center.
Yeah, definitely. And it'd be remiss of me not to acknowledge that it's April and this is Child Abuse Prevention Month. So in line with that, you know, we do see families when a child has experienced abuse. And even when that happens, we provide a lot of psychoeducation to really support the family in regards to hopefully prevent another instance of abuse in the future. So I think one of the things that's important to talk about is child abuse prevention, right? And a lot of times, you know, the psychoeducation about it, regardless of your socioeconomic background, race, and things of that nature, it's important for all of us to be aware of child abuse and childhood trauma and things of that nature, right? And I'm going to talk about ACEs in a bit, really see how that connects to like long-term effects. But in regards to child abuse prevention, you know, some of the things that we talk about with parents and when we do community, because it's not just, yes, it's the services we provide here, but we also go into the community to do workshops and things of that nature. And one of the things we talk about is a lot of the misconceptions that are out there. First thing is parents feel sometimes the information is that like, oh, teach your kids about stranger danger. And that research has shown long gone, you know, when children are abused, most likely more than 50% of the cases, they're abused by someone they know, right? Or a loved one. So you can't just teach them to stay away from strangers and be mindful of their, when they're around strangers, they should also be mindful around family members, close friends and things of that nature. So that's the first thing we teach, you know, parents in regards to keeping kids safe is really having this language of, you know, be careful around everyone. Right? When someone does something that makes you feel uncomfortable, let me know. Let me know right away. And even if I do, like as a parent, even if I do something that makes you feel funny, strange, weird, bad, or uncomfortable, let me know or let someone else know. And we always say when educating them about abuse and trauma and things of that nature, tell someone and keep telling until it stops. Right? Because there are cases where children have told someone about a physical abuse or sexual abuse that's happening and the adult didn't tell, right? And so that's why we say keep telling right? If you tell one person and it doesn't stop, tell someone else until it stops. So just, I should have backtracked and talked about this, but it's important to talk to kids about, you know, body safety, right? Talking to them to have them be educated on what we like to say the doctor's names for body parts, because oftentimes parents will give cute names to body parts. But what happens is if there's any type of inappropriate touching or violations of those body parts, when they go tell someone else, the person doesn't understand what they're talking about. You know, there's this classic case that's used in really bringing it home about how this is important in teaching kids doctor's name is, you know, a kid being taught that their a private part is being called a flower rather than, you know, the doctor's name of vagina. And what happens if they go tell a teacher like, oh, someone's touching my flower, you're thinking like, oh, okay, it's a flower. Like, yeah, when people think flowers are beautiful, they touch it, right? And that's it's a serious miscommunication right there. The teacher doesn't think much of it. But if a kid goes up to the teacher and says, someone's touching my vagina, it's a totally different reaction and response. So that's why we really teach parents, teach them the doctor's names, right? And so that's important in regards to safety, because then they can have a clear language to others in regards to getting help. Other things such as providing parent supports, you know, parent support groups are important, you know, especially for any kind of plethora of issues that can be happening. First time parents, parents that are overwhelmed going back to work and things of that nature. Support groups are very helpful and is a good resource in prevention and things of that nature. And also talking to parents about in regards to, you know, when we're disciplining kids, right? Try not to do it when you're angry or upset. And this also models for kids in times where sometimes we just need to calm down a little bit and then we could talk a bit more clear. Because there are instances where parents are physically engaged in physical discipline, they're angry, it leads to abuse and things of that nature. So just different types of really parent support strategies and psychoeducation to help them and guide them in more different approaches to child abuse prevention.
Makes sense. So a lot of it, and to no surprise, falls on parents' education, right? Because kids are young and learning and figuring things out as they go. And parents have to play a big role in education and understanding and awareness. Like you said in the beginning, I thought that was a good point on stranger danger, something like, you know, that like our, you know, my parents or whoever's parents might have grown up and kind of taught us. And people may not be, not that you have to be on edge, like whoever's around you, but be aware of common or things that are considered abnormal. And how would you know that if nobody ever talked to you about it or explained it to you? So it sounds like you do a lot of work too with groups, both parents and children, and kind of the education process around that stuff to kind of just heighten awareness, right?
So. Yep, absolutely, absolutely. And really, you know, just to further clarify when I'm saying parents, just caregivers. Right? Caregivers. And research has shown, even, you know, some people may feel as though, oh, if they're not with, you know, a biological parent, things of that nature, that's a big issue. Research has shown that, you know, a real good protective factor is a child having, you know, a consistent adult caregiver. And that could be a grandparent, an uncle, right? Parents, as well. So really that's important. And, you know, just caregivers being aware of this information. And that's why I'm saying, even if you don't have a child, right? There's a child in your community that you're aware of. Having this information is important, right? Because community supports are important, right? So you see a parent that, you know, you can provide that information to that parent, right? Once you're educated on child abuse and prevention, And that can really help, you know, that child's life. So that's why I can't emphasize enough, we all need to be aware of this and do our part.
Yeah, that's a good point. It doesn't fall on any one person or one role within a community in order for it to be successful and kind of beneficial to everybody. So I appreciate that. Is there anything else on specifically related to Winona's House that you wanted to share? I'm sure it may come up throughout some of the other topics that we're going to discuss, such as ACEs and things like that. But anything else before we kind of move on?
No, I mean, really just get to know the Child Advocacy Center, right? And the supports and services they provide. And it could be a preventative measure before something happens, right? Just if you're not sure or of the information on child abuse prevention, contact your local Child Advocacy Center so they can provide you with that information and see if they're holding any informational sessions and things of that nature. So it's a resource that's there for the community. Utilize it.
Yeah, no, great. Thank you for that. And I know we talked about this a little, it kind of fits a little bit into this discussion, but much broader as well. We talked about it a little earlier, but just the overall mental health aspects of, and maybe you can share a little bit about your experience from your professional background during the pandemic that nobody wants to talk about anymore, but here we are. 2020 shows into Garden State Debate and everyone and 16 months or however many months into the pandemic, and it seems to still be on the front lines in some aspect of everyone's mind. So we were talking a little bit about the mental health aspects and how do you balance them against the actual virus aspects and being in school, not being in school, parents as well, who are trying to support their children throughout these experiences. And you were explaining to me a little bit about it and your thoughts. So if you don't mind, if you could share a little bit about that, I think that was pretty helpful.
Yeah, absolutely. You know, the current COVID-19 pandemic that we're experiencing, you know, it definitely, we have to be aware and mindful of the mental health effects of it, right? So we are dealing with the social isolation piece and loss around that. And the loss piece is very unique in that there's two types of loss, right? So losing a family member and things of that nature, but also the loss of experience. You know, when I talk about the impact on children and adolescents, that's the big thing that I bring up, is in addition to having to deal with losing a family member, they also have to deal with the loss of experience, right? And not being in the school environment. And some kids have missed, you know, proms, graduations, and things of that nature due to the pandemic. And it's, although as adults, we look at it as, oh, it's not that serious. Yeah, that's because we experienced it and have made our own judgments of it. But this is something that they look forward to. Right. And so we have to recognize how that impacts them, and we shouldn't minimize it if they're greatly impacted by that, because some may never have the opportunity to go to a prom and things of that nature. Granted, I can hear it now, people saying, oh, the prom is not that serious, I didn't go. OK, but for some it is. Right. We have to remember when we were kids where, you know, these milestones per se within us being kids were important. And so, you know, even if there are special events that happen at a certain time of year at the school that students are looking forward to, they're missing those experiences. And so we really have to consider the mental health impact of that. And then the socialization, you know, kids that had extracurricular activities that are having to go a whole year without it. It was life for them, right? As some may say, like, oh, basketball is life, track is life, whatever catchphrase they use, that's what's important for them at that time. And so it really is something that we should consider. And like, in addition to us thinking about planning going back with you know, safe physical safety and things of that nature, we have to also start planning about how we're going to address the mental health impact of the COVID-19 pandemic. And the unique thing about right now, the experience right now with COVID-19, oh, one other thing, also we have to consider the anxiety, the, you know, increased anxiety of the virus for individuals, right? Because this COVID pandemic is so unique that we can't see, you know, who has it. We can't see the variables like in the air to say like, oh, we have to stay safe. It elevates our anxiety, right? And we don't know how some children may have been dealing with that. And then the added layer of, you know, what I would call this mass trauma we're going through right now, of the COVID-19 pandemic, is the social unrest that we've had, right? I say it's like we're going through another pandemic, of which we've known has been happening with racism, police brutality, and things of that nature, but it's in our faces, right? And kids are being exposed to that too, as well, through social media outlets, which is another concern, is, you know, how there's so much exposure to things like violence and things of that nature that we shouldn't be seeing. So those two things are happening at the same time, and it can weigh a lot. You know, racial trauma has significant impacts, and the same symptoms of PTSD can be felt through an experience of racial trauma as well. So there's a lot going on right now that we have to be prepared to address and support people through as it relates to mental health.
Doesn't sound like a simple one-stop shop solution here as we continue down the path. And I think it's interesting. I mean, you use the prom as an example, but like we were speaking earlier, it could be just the small conversations, like think back to when we were younger, the kids are used to having in hallways or wherever, class, extracurricular activities, sports, educational stuff where they get to see their friends and work on stuff that, you know, like you said, as parents, we can look back and put it in perspective and, we went on to, you know, do XYZ and jobs and now we're, you know, parents or caregivers and things like that. So it's not a big deal, but the aggregation of the accumulation of these events over time, like you mentioned, and adding in the other complexities, and then the gray area of maybe not being able to see it all, as far as it relates to the virus, unless, you know, you unfortunately have someone in your family or friends that are actually sick. So it seems like there would be a lot of confusion and stress. And you mentioned earlier that some of the students that are, you know, COVID fatigue is, as it relates to the mental aspects. I think that was something interesting you mentioned earlier. In sort of the virtual educational environment, not to make any light about the actual health aspects of the virus and the need for people to adhere to all the guidelines that are presented to us, but you had made a good point about some of the you know, previously most smartest and connected students have been becoming, from what you've seen, a little bit less engaged, right?
Absolutely. So yeah, and I call it like the COVID wall, where those students, just the fatigue, and it was students and adults, even as adults, like we're tired of being on Zoom. Everything is on Zoom, and having, not even just Zoom. I don't want anyone to feel as though I'm in against Zoom, not just in this virtual world, right? Of whether it's Zoom, GoToMeeting, whatever you're using, it's exhausting, right, at this point. And people are starting to really hit that wall, that COVID wall, and they're just fatigued by it. And you're seeing it, you know, even high performing students are just putting in the bare minimum effort now because they're tired of virtual learning. So it's a challenge for so many different stakeholders, from, you know, the CDC to different parts of government, teachers, parents, and things of that nature, where we're constantly having the balance. How can we change the dynamic? How can we move forward while still having to keep people safe, right? So some schools have went back 100%, and you know, the response have been great. And it's this battle or challenge, shall I say, where students are back, but some teachers may feel like this is not safe because I'm seeing that students are not complying with the safety protocols in place. And in some environments they are. So it's, you know, it's tough because we have to try to have empathy on all sides. And we definitely know for parents or caregivers, there's an impact there too, where some of them, their jobs are saying it's time to come back, but yet their kids are having to still stay home to do virtual learning and they're trying to figure out childcare, you know? Or they're just not comfortable sending their kids back yet and they're seeing that decline in performance. So we really got to support each other and figure things out in a way that, you know, we're keeping everyone safe, because that is the number one priority right now, is to keep us safe against this pandemic, you know. And I think as we see numbers go up with those getting vaccines and hope and seeing what happens from that, you know, things may change, but it's tough on every side for everyone. And we really have to have empathy while still trying to progress and keep everyone safe. It's challenging.
Absolutely. And I think it's all just the extension of one thing to the next has probably led to that wall. And from my perspective, you know, going back to March of 2020, when everyone was like, oh yeah, we're going home for 2 to 3 weeks.
Exactly. Yeah. Everyone thought like, oh, this is just, sorry. This is 14. Oh, it's just a 14 day thing. And you know, you saw people like, oh, day two, you know, and making light of it. Now we're at what, day three?
I lost count
because, you know.
And then adding in the gray area of, well, we keep making strides visibly. We can see them in terms of, first it was like therapeutics and watching the numbers and, you know, it was down in the summer of last, and the second wave led or whatever you want to call it, and then now like, oh, vaccines are great, or immunity, but you know, the rate of transmission is still high. I'm not trying to act like a doctor here, just from the last person that was on the show. And you know, I think the gray area of not knowing exactly, maybe for these, going back to relating to students, parents, caregivers, adults, not knowing when maybe we will be fully ready to do normal activities as communities is also something that, if adults are struggling with it, I couldn't imagine, you know, my kids are younger, so like a high school kid or even younger are thinking about it and all the questions around it and parents having to try to answer as best they can and educate and stuff like that. So that it definitely seems like a very complex thing, but just wanted to move on to, I know you mentioned through the state there recently, I think in 2020, and I'll let you fill in the gaps here, developed an office of resilience, and under that I think you have some involvement with that. So maybe and within that I think is the ACEs work, the adverse child experience. So maybe we can dive into that if you don't mind.
Yeah, sure. So first, just to really get an understanding of ACEs, adverse childhood experiences. So ACEs are, you know, potentially negative incidents that children experience that can potentially be traumatic. And so what happens when, depending on the number of ACEs that are experienced, and let me just go through the different categories of them. It could be physical abuse, emotional abuse, sexual abuse, physical neglect, emotional neglect, you know, having a caregiver, parent with mental illness, having a relative that was incarcerated, you know, a parent that experienced or, you know, had some difficulties with substances and substance abuse and things of that nature. So within those categories, if a child has experienced some of those, you know, it's pretty much ranked the number of those experiences you've had, there's really this trajectory and connection between the number of ACEs experienced and outcomes in later life, right? So we know that the research has shown that 67% of the population has experienced at least one ACE, right, from the categories that I've provided. And so the research shows that when there's four or more ACEs that are experienced, the individual is three times more likely to have lung disease or adult smoking, 11 times more likely to engage in substance abuse, and 14 times more likely to attempt suicide and things of that nature, right? Of course, there's, you know, variability in those numbers a bit, but this really shows the connection between a childhood adversity that's experienced and long-term effects due to that, right? Whether it's mental or, you know, physical, emotional effects of it and things of that nature. And so this really is based out of a study that was done in the 90s through Kaiser Permanente, CDC, and things of that nature. And they came about this, they discovered this through that study. And you know, looking at the effects of this, you would think that a lot of places are very proactive into it, right? Especially for medical doctors, because when kids come into the office, having screenings in place to see if they've, the number of ACEs they've experiencing and connecting them to the right resources. But not everyone is very proactive in that. And the good thing is New Jersey is, right? Like I mentioned, they created this Office of Resilience last year in 2020, even during a pandemic, still proactive in regards to seeing the need as to we have to get this done. And through that, you know, they've created acesconnection.com, where I believe that's the website. I hope I stated it right.
Where no, we'll put on, sorry to interrupt, we'll put all this, the information up on after when we release the show on any of this stuff. So.
Awesome. And so it's where, you know, you can get more information about it. And then there's a lot of resources that's going to be coming out of that department. You know, they've done very thorough research into ACEs and how our state is impacted by ACEs. There's going to be a center created in regards to providing support in different avenues to address ACEs. And the piece that, you know, I'm fortunate to be a part of was just in regards to the campaign. And so definitely the community should be looking out for a campaign coming out to kind of really increase our awareness, right? So I'm talking about the importance of us having knowledge of different things. And this is one of the approaches, right? In having this campaign is to increase everyone's awareness around ACEs and understanding the impact of adverse childhood experiences. You know, we're in Child Abuse Prevention Month, and that's the key thing, is to increase our awareness on the impact of traumatic childhood experiences. So I'm really, you know, happy that the state is proactive in regards to the ACEs work, and really looking forward to all of the things that's gonna come out of the Office of Resilience as it relates to that.
That's great. Now I imagine that, the establishment of the office itself is a big deal, but there's probably a lot of work to be done in terms of ramping things up. And even what you had mentioned, like the advisory piece that you're a part of, and getting that information out there for the public, right? So yeah. I'll be looking forward to seeing more stuff on that.
Yes. And when I have the information, sorry to cut you off, the information I shared with you, so you can have it on the site for your viewers.
Great, no, that sounds great. And another thing that stuck out, and you mentioned in the beginning, and it's just like an example that a lot of people may be aware of, you said it in the beginning and it might be relevant to what you were just saying about the number of factors and what they could lead to, and you mentioned DMX, right?
So yes,
those are that's an example of what you just spoke about.
Yeah, you know, when I, it's just looking at his life in transparency and sharing his early childhood experiences. You know, he recently passed away due to an overdose. And, you know, we're talking about ACEs and not just looking at him and saying what's wrong with him and things of that nature, like, oh, he's using substances, why, what's wrong with him? And having that trauma-informed perspective of what happened to you, we can really see that trajectory, right? Where he experienced childhood abuse, was in and out of foster homes, and so that instability in housing and things of that nature. And also, he actually had a trusted adult mentor who exposed him to drugs, and then, you know, had this long battle with substances and subsequently died of an overdose. So, you know, I'm grateful for his he's been very transparent about his life experiences throughout his career and things of that nature. And it's just very unfortunate right now just to, you know, see that his life came to substance and overdose and things of that nature. So, you know, the unique thing, the great thing about this work of trauma is recognizing that resilience is a factor and happens as well, right? Because I know for me, when I first learned about, was really got heavy into the work of trauma, I was just, you just feel like down, like, oh my goodness, you know, even hearing of ACEs, it's like, oh, okay, so you're saying if someone experiences or has this number of ACEs, they're doomed. No, that's why we do child abuse prevention. That's why there is an Office of Resilience in New Jersey, because we want to increase our awareness of the impact of childhood experiences and put these protective factors or preventative measures in place. So for instance, if a child has a caregiver that has been incarcerated, you know, putting programs within correctional facilities that work on people's transition back into the community, right? And having supports while they're in the community, working with different employers and things of that nature to help transition inmates into, you know, really providing that support with jobs and education and things of that nature, so that, you know, they can, this will help to reduce, you know, returning back into the justice system and things of that nature. Putting parent support in place. So if it was a two-parent home and one parent is incarcerated, what kind of supports are we providing for the other parent, right? That are now having to take care of the responsibilities on their own. And then what supports are we providing for the child who has a caregiver or even a sibling that's been incarcerated? You know, these are the protective factors that need to be in place to support people from the impact of traumatic experiences. And that's just one example that I provide. And there's so many others that we can do to really start this shift and see how resilience come into play. So adversity, our awareness lets us know that adversities happen, trauma happen, but we have to do, you know, our part in advocating and putting in support services so that we can support and help people overcome the adversity and trauma that they've experienced.
Yeah, no, thanks for that. Makes a lot of sense. And not to go back to what you said earlier, but one thing that I failed to mention before when you brought it up was, once going back to the children getting back to school, some schools in New Jersey, right, have not been back at all, others hybrid, whatever. And at some point in time, hopefully sooner than later, in a safe way, children will be back in schools permanently and COVID will be behind us. And with that, well, they might not all come waltzing through the door like, you know, they weren't just traumatized in a way through the last however many months it'll be at that point in time. So do you have like, and you kind of alluded to it earlier, but do you have kind of like thoughts on, there's going to be need to be an extra layer of supports and support and care for children as they re-enter schools with all of these complex different things that have occurred while they were outside. And as we spoke to Dominic and Gail last time, school was a big part of reporting and a big part of the piece of the puzzle of, you know, like we talked about earlier, it's not just on one person or the caregiver or the child or, you know, someone in the community. It kind of needs everyone. So do you have any opinion, not opinion, any just thoughts on as children get fully back to school, what it might, what we might need from a support?
Yes, absolutely. You know, I definitely feel as though the Department of Education will need that support from providers or different agencies in regards to, like, how are we going to support our students as they transition back? First thing, we recognize that loss has happened, right? So we don't know if certain schools, school districts, like how many teachers have been lost or school staff have been lost, and children are having to go back, and that reality will hit them, right? And then, so that's in one aspect. And then those children that have lost loved ones, you know, and being proactive in regards to that is, are we gonna have support groups in school, right? Counselors being trained on how to help navigate that discussion around loss and things of that nature. And I talk about too, you know, the impact of the racial trauma that's experienced. Like now that students are back in the school setting, are we going to have programming around, you know, increased diversity, equity, inclusion work, and addressing racial trauma? So really having these supports in place, keeping in mind all that students have experienced that we haven't been able to, you know, when they're in the school building, provide those supports because it's been challenging with the virtual world. Having those things in place would be important. And if it can't be done in the school environment, getting those community resources in place to be able to link families up to those services or trainers in the community that could come in and work with the kids, and also the caregivers, right? Are we having, you know, lunch and learns with caregivers around how to have difficult conversations with your kids surrounding racial trauma and the impact of what's happening in regards to, you know, the social unrest right now? Are we having those same conversations with parents and how to support their kids around it? So really including the parent is, the caregiver is just as important. And, you know, it's a lot of responsibility on the school, but the schools are the ones that see the kids most of the time, you know, throughout the day. And so we really have to do some community building with the schools in partnership with schools to provide the supports to address the mental health challenges and, you know, that students are experiencing right now. So hopefully there'll be a lot of community building and connections made to support the school systems in regards to students transitioning back. Right. And it's hard because you can live in one area and it's like, well, that school is back 100% and this one's not. It's hard. it's really hard.
Yeah. I get it both. If you're, it's so customized to a school, and we don't have to get into, we were talking earlier, to a school and a community and what's going on, and obviously teachers' health and things like that. So, but you'd like to think that when the doors open back up and everyone's walking in physically, that, you know, they'll be, the resilient kids are resilient to begin with, that everything will just snap back in place. And I'm not saying that it should all be put on schools to fix, you know, caregivers. I have a heavy responsibility to make sure that my kids are as well prepared as I can be, you know, when they're at home. But it seems like there's going to have to be a lot of, you know, like you said, a community-wide effort to minimize and transition and prepare, you know, because I personally haven't, you know, whether it's something small and it could be relative to something large, but I personally haven't met anyone that hasn't lost something during this pandemic. And I'd like to find, if there's anyone in the state who's listening to this show, shoot me an email if you have. But there's definitely silver linings and positives that have come out of it. But certainly there's losses and all in a wide range of different things. A lot of what you mentioned, and we could put up a whole slide of 25 things that you know, from large scale type things, like you said, like social unrest and things like that, all the way down to, you know, missing your best friend for the last year or whatever the case is. But it doesn't sound like an easy task, but I wanted to thank you again for coming on and all of your insights. I think it's extremely helpful to continue the conversation that we had with Wynonna's House. And thank you for bringing up, by the way, Child Abuse Awareness Month, which is April. I didn't mention it in the beginning of the show. Dominic's going to be really mad at me, so I apologize, Dominic and Gail. But please say hi to everybody at the Advocacy Center. But I'm sure we'll be talking to everybody soon. But with that, I think we learned a lot today, and I appreciate you coming on. But if you have any last final thoughts for everyone, maybe any positive notes to leave us on or anything, that would be great. And I'll be putting out the information regarding ACEs and anything else relative to the conversation when we release it.
Yeah. So, you know, my biggest thing is I put out a lot that can be very impactful in regards to trauma, adversity, and things of that nature. And the piece that I am a big advocate for is also recognizing resilience. So, you know, we have to be real with ourselves to recognize that trauma and adversity happens, while also in that same breath acknowledging that resilience happens as well. So it's on, you know, as a community, working with each other, partnering with each other to, you know, really help us to overcome the trauma and adversity that we're experiencing. So I thank you for having me here. And just the fact that you would have such a topic on your podcast is important, right? Because I'm sure you have a plethora of, you know, different backgrounds in regarding to your audience. And now we're reaching out and educating more people on child abuse, you know, adverse childhood experiences and things of that nature. So thank you so much. And I'm very grateful and honored to speak with you today about these different things. You know, it's a very crucial time right now where we're going through two pandemics. But the silver lining is it really has increased our awareness on so many things that have been hidden for so many years. People, you know, one of the things that people say is like, oh, well, if we look back, we were a pretty dirty nation to begin with.
By not standing up a little bit, right? We're trying to. We're right. Getting skeletons out.
We've gotten a bit cleaner. But then in regards to, you know, the social unrest, we have to do better. And, you know, we really need to do better in providing equality and creating a more inclusive environment for everyone. So on all avenues, hopefully the resilience piece is how we're going to overcome what we're experiencing right now. So thank you so much for having me. I can talk for hours on these things. So
no, it's great. It's been great meeting with you, and we've talked a couple times prior, and you have so much experience that I'm always learning. I've learned a lot today, and hopefully the viewers have. I really appreciate you coming on. Like you said, this is a very significant issue, topic that needs to be talked about, and we're not going to let it go. Not, you know, for the viewership and audio listeners of this podcast, in our communities, I think that it deserves, a good portion of time. So we're going to continue our Wynonna's House and Friends and Advocates series, and we'll be speaking to the crew as we go on further down the path. But hopefully people that come in to the show find something for everyone, and then they stay tuned and they listen to this, and they stay tuned and listen to something that they may not have arrived to listen to in the first place. So that's the goal, to get people on and different diversity of topics and great guests like yourself. So I really appreciate it. Dr. Prempeh, psychologist of Newark Beth Israel Medical Center under RWJ Barnabas, and part of the RDTC program at Wynonna's House. Thank you for your time, and we really appreciate it. Have a good day, and we'll talk to you soon.
You too. Be well.
All right. You too.
Garden State Debate, where the talk is real. Garden State Debate. No joke, no frills. Garden State Debate. It's the talk of the town. Garden State Debate. People all around, yeah. Garden State Debate.
Garden State Debate.
Garden State Debate.